ज्ञानतिमिरन्धस्य ज्ञानं जनशलाकय चाक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः। नमः श्रेष्ठं मनुमाभिसच्चिपुत्रं मत्रास्वरूपं रूपं तस्याग्रजमरूपुरीं मथुरीं गोष्ठावतीं राधाकुन्दं गिरिवरमहो राधिकमधावसं प्राप्तु यस्य प्रतीत्यकृपया श्रीगुरुं तं नतोऽस्मि वंशकल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धुभ्यैव च पतितानं पवानेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः। निखिलाश्रुतिमौलैरत्नमालदितिनिराजितपदपङ्कजन्त आजीमुक्तकुलैरुपशामनं परितस्त्वं हरिणं संश्रयामि। अनारपितचरिं चिरत्करुणयावतीर्णाकलहं समार्पयितुमुन्नतोष्फलरासं स्वभक्तिश्रियम् हरिपुरतसुन्दराद्युतिकदम्बसन्दीपितः सदा हृदये कन्दरेस्फुरतो वासचिनन्दनः। अजानुलम्बिता भुजकनकावदात् सङ्कीर्तनैकपितरो कमलाय दक्षं विश्वम्बरोद्वयाबुरुजुगधार्मपाल वन्दे जगत्प्रियकरो करुणावतारो। लादिनीशक्तिस्वरूपाय गौरङ्गसुहृदाय च भक्तशक्तिप्रदनाय गदाधर नमस्तुते। हे कृष्णा करुणासिन्धो दीनबन्धो जगत्पते गोपेशा गोपीककान्ता राधाकान्ता नमोऽस्तुते। राधिवृन्दवनादिशेखरनम्रितवाहिनी कृपया निजपादब्जादस्यन्मह्यं प्रदीयतम्। भक्त्यभिहीनायपराधलक्षये क्षिप्तशाकमादितरङ्गमाद्य कृपामयि त्वं शरणं प्रपानम् वृन्देन्मस्ते चरणारविन्दं वृन्देन्मस्ते चरणारविन्दम्। श्री सच्चिदानन्द गौर हरि की जय। श्री हरि नाम प्रभु की जय। समवेत भक्त वृंद की जय। गौर प्रेमानंद हरि हरि बोल। सो वेलकम यू ऑल अगेन। ग्रीटिंग्स फ्रॉम दावोस स्विट्जरलैंड। दिस टाइम आई हैव बीन हियर फॉर द लास्ट 2-3 डेज। Well, we are conducting, having a retreat. The name of the retreat was Embodiment, if I'm not mistaken, Embodiment and Relationship in Bhakti. So we are sharing with a group of 20-ish brothers and sisters, very nourishing exchange. Today we have been talking about in the morning vulnerability, sacred vulnerability, and embodying honesty in our relationships. Now we have been talking about practicing bhakti in the daily, in the day, in our everyday life, basically. So yeah, very, very nourishing discussions always. Even if the topics, I mean, how many times we have been talked about vulnerability and topics like that, but still there's no end, right, to how much we can embrace those truths and claim them as our own truth, basically. So it's been very moving. I'm having some interesting gifts that I'm receiving. Let me show you one of those. It's a local artist, 10-year-old artist, very nice drawing. You see the look, the eyes of Krishna and the cow, both of them. Anyhow, some nice offerings that are coming. And of course, a few days before we were still in, I was, not we were, I was by myself. Of course, there's always someone else. But there was a solitary retreat in Siam Priyakunj in the Swiss Alps. And nice time. Finished writing some articles that probably will be publishing starting next week as an extension of my recent conversation with Swami Medananda, if you can remember, about impersonal and personal. And he in the podcast, we have invited me like to write something about religious pluralism in Gaudiya Vaishnavism. So I honored his invitation, and yeah, their three-part series came on the topic of us acknowledging endless forms of the divine. Part two, accepting the impersonal dimension. Part three, do we see Brahman as inferior of Bhagavan, or do we see them as equally but from different perspectives, basically? So that will be the exploration. I think it's a necessary conversation because sometimes we do relatively well in interfaith dialogue, but when it comes to impersonal practitioners, we have no mercy then. They belong to a particular box, right? So I think it's important to open that conversation and to acknowledge the possibility of the impersonal as, of course, may not be our cup of tea, but as something that it has its place in eternity. So if someone has its place in eternity, it's glorious in its own way. I mean, how can I dare to minimize, downplay, what to speak of, insult something that is going on in transcendence for eternity, right? So I think it's humbling and important to learn to acknowledge those things that are not our cup of tea, but it's in the menu of many other people. So it's not my menu, but there are many menus in the restaurant, so to say. So anyhow, happy to be here with all of you today. And looking forward to whatever has to come and be revealed in today's conversation. So there are a few raised hands, and of course, that's our method, so to say. Whomever wants to bring something to the table, we can raise your digital hand, or if you don't know how to do that, you can send a written message or whatever. We'll try to honor that in one way or another. So I'm seeing Divyangana first in the queue. So from France, I suppose. So invited to unmute yourself, and those who can and have time, of course, invite to activate your video so we can also relate in as many dimensions as possible.
Haribol Maharaj. Haribol, everybody. Thank you very much. Yes, I wanted to ask one question. Because when you came to visit us in Dijon, I really like how you introduced the class. You were asking us, who are you? And the next day we come again and you ask again, who are you? And it was very interesting for me. Like in my Sangha, I felt like it was the first time that we kind of really share somehow where we are going inside in our journey. And yeah, actually, I was wondering, if maybe that could be something that could be very positive in our Sangha, to share these things, because I think we really like each other. We are I see a very lot of good-hearted people. Sorry, I'm speaking a little bit long. But for example, sometimes I experience things and I feel like I'm a little bit lonely in these things. One thing, for example, I notice when it's like Ekadashi day or holiday, like very holiday, like Radhastami or something. I always think, oh, I want to chant so many japa, or I want to do this, I want to do that, I want to do Abhishek. But then on these days, it's like all my things inside are coming up, and all my energy is just trying to hold all this emotion inside myself and go through somehow. And I started to think, okay, because it's happening on this special day, it has it has to have some reason. It's not a hazard. But also, I feel like, oh, maybe I'm just the only one, and I have so many things inside, so I cannot focus on what I want to focus. But at the same time, I listened to your class, and you said, when you have an obstacle, it's actually a blessing that we don't see that it's a blessing already. And so I'm sorry, it's very dense, but yes, I would say some, like you see, certain things are happening in my inner world, and I feel like sometimes I would like to share it with others to know, like, is it normal, is it not normal? So, yeah, how maybe to introduce that in my Sangha, and also the question that goes with it, like, is it normal to experience this intensity of emotion on a holiday, or is it like just me? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing the topic, Divyangana. We appreciate it. And of course, I will say, in one sense, I will say you are not alone in whatever you are experiencing. At the same time, I will say each one experiences their own journey in a very unique way. So I won't say, yeah, absolutely everything you experienced, we also experience. Not necessarily. But also, I wouldn't say nothing of what you experience is. We experience nothing of what you experience. So I wouldn't say that either. No, that will be two extremes. So we all share so much in common, and we also share so many differences, so to say. That's the beauty of life. Achintya bheda bhed. Difference and non-difference. No, so we share so much in common. There are so many differences at the same time in the context of what we share in common. So you are mentioning, for example, that in some special days, which of course I will make the footnote there that every day is a special day, just in case. No, let's not wait for Radhastami to feel it's a special day. Every day, as we were talking the other day with Krishna Chandra Prabhu, one day before Janmashtami, and we were talking how Janmashtami is not a one day in a year event. Every single day, because Rupa Goswami says, you can attain all perfection by celebrating Janmashtami. He gives 64 practices of bhakti. And all of the other practices, you can practice them every day. But this one only, it seems to be limited to one day a year. But we concluded, no, you can celebrate Janmashtami every day. In the sense of you can honor Krishna's birth in your heart on a daily basis. So in that sense, you can, how to say, every day can be a special day. But just to make that point, so we don't think, okay, we have these special days a year and the other days are not special, right? But at the same time, yeah, if it's possible that in a holy day or in a special celebration like the ones you mentioned, some stuff is coming. That's your celebration, so to say. Those are the gifts to be honored on that particular day. It doesn't mean that it will be like that forever, right? And I know that we may have this expectation, okay, now comes whatever, Radhastami or Gokurnima or whatever celebration. I like to be very peaceful and very present and very whatever, to be honoring this day and celebrating, and as you said, chant more japa or absorb myself. Well, outside there are a few kids playing with carts. It's very noisy. I'll wait a little bit more. If not, I will disappear for a moment and beg for mercy from the kids. Yeah, you cannot hear anything, but I can tell you. So I will say, if that's what's happening now, doesn't mean it will happen forever. And for some reason, that's coming. No? Like, for example, people go into a dham, to some place of concentrated people living there and practicing spiritual life. So I cannot tell you how many times people tell me, okay, I go to Vrindavan with this romantic idea of my experience, and all this stuff is coming out, and I'm a mess in the holy, only holy city. And it was not what I was planning. but it was what it had to happen. And it's okay. That's a symptom that some things are being brought to our attention, and we should be as painful as an unsettling and even as embarrassing as we may feel it is. It's glorious in its own way. It's beautiful. Because I'm becoming aware of something that it was already there, but I was not aware. So I was kind of numbed to that reality, and now it's becoming alive, painfully alive, but alive. Right? So that's why Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, as I like to say, when he describes anartha nivritti, and he describes anarthas in the context of speaking about anartha nivritti, and he describes stages of unstable bhakti, and he mentions all of them, and we can feel, oh, it's so embarrassing, I'm so ashamed of being going through all that, or we can think those stages are symptoms that I'm on the path. Right? As embarrassing as they may be, there are symptoms of that. Like Mahaprabhu's mentioning these seven effects of the holy name in the first verse of Shikshastakam, right? So the last ones are all very ecstatic. Pratipadam Purnamrita Shradhanam, no? Anandam Buddhivardhanam. I'm immersed into an ocean of bliss, and at every step I'm tasting the nectar of immortality. Kijai, right? But you can only get there if you first go through the previous stages. And the first one is Chetudarpanamarjuna, which means basically what Manjwala is doing at this moment, clean the mirror, no? She's cleaning the glasses as Rasangi did with her camera a few minutes ago. Mahaprabhu said, Chetudarpanamarjuna, clean the mirror of your citta. Citta means your subconscious mind. So that's very interesting. Right? The very first word Mahaprabhu refers to in this glories of the name is your subconscious. Clean the mirror of your subconscious. Let's put it in another way. Confront your shadow. Oops. Right? Doesn't feel glorious, right? It doesn't feel like even like an attainment. It feels like being defeated or losing or witnessing something not so glorious, quote unquote, but it's glorious in its own way if we learn to know about it. Okay, the kids are intense. Give me a second. Okay. I hope they understand English because probably they only speak German. I will realize that in a few minutes. If the volume gets higher, they only speak German. And probably they understood me telling them, get higher, get higher. So that on one side, and then as you were asking how to introduce sharing your experiences in your Sangha, of course, that's very personal and specific. I cannot tell people how to do things in their own particular group because each group has their own mode and ways, and it's not one way. It's not that one group is just this and this group is just this. We are just a group of individuals and each one has their own flavor. But of course, I don't see in these things as being introduced like, okay, from now on we have this new law and we'll be doing this in this way. But it has to just happen very, very organically. Right, like Rupa Goswami will say, right? Like Guhyama Kyati Prichati, that's in the Shastra. Reveal your mind in confidence with like-minded spirits. Swajatiya Sadhu Sangha, no? Association should be with like-minded people. So we don't need to make an event or a public announcement to start doing that. It's just trying to share our hearts with people we trust. But of course, as we're talking today, we were talking about vulnerability today a lot. But also, as much as we talked about vulnerability, we talked about the importance of first creating a safe space to be vulnerable. Because I can talk about vulnerability as much as I can, but if you don't feel safe, the more I talk about vulnerability, the more terrified you will be. So, first, the safe space has to be naturally created. I cannot even convince you that you are in a safe space. It has to be felt and accept it naturally. So we have to relate to people in from places that we both feel safe, and that invites for vulnerability, for openness, for sincerity, for sharing our journey. Can be with one second person, a third person. Eventually, you may be able to do some circle sharing and collective sharing of the hearts in a very sacred, protected, safe space. But again, all this needs to it may take time, right? We cannot just like expect everything to be working immediately. So it begins with us, with people like you asking the question you asked, showing concern, showing a healthy preoccupation of, okay, I need to share my journey. I need to see if I'm alone in all this, or if there's, is there anybody out there, as the song will say, is there someone else feeling what I'm feeling? Or because it can be very heavy to feel on top of what we may be feeling, which could be heavy in itself. If you add on top of that a layer of isolation, what I am the only one feeling this, that what makes the thing 108 times worse. But when you share that heavy thing, whatever that may be, with people that reflect back, that mirror back your joys, your troubles, your wounds, whatever, in a healthy way, that heals and empowers you. And so, yeah, it's very necessary. So the first step is to acknowledge, I have that necessity. It's okay. It's legal, so to say. It's not something, a deviation from the norm or a transgression of the tradition. On the contrary, it's the very essence of it. As I try to always bring Sanskrit terms for devotees to feel sure enough that they are not deviating from the norm. I mean, I personally do not need to use those words, but sometimes devotees need to, oh, that's sadhu sangha because of this verse. And okay, we are in legal terms still. But we can speak about this without the need of going there, but we can go there, of course. So sadhu sangha is that, revealing the mind, sharing in our hearts, sharing our journey. That's why I quote the Vishwanath Chakravarti on this and that. So yeah, it's all part of the experience, no? So it's all happening. As long as it happens in a context of sincerity, that's redeeming. No? As long as all the ups and downs and messiness and woundedness and brokenness happen in the context of an honest assessment of reality, of a sincere desire to give my heart more, it's all sacred, basically. It's all blessed. And those difficulties will bring their own lessons. No? So those are some thoughts. I don't know if that helps.
Oh, thank you very much. Very, very nice. Thank you, Maharaj.
No, thank you. Thank you for bringing the topic. It's always important one, necessary one. And I can tell you now, traveling and talking with people here, you can see the necessity for that, no? For having spaces of honest sharing and safe. Again, as I say, it's not just about, okay, guys, be fully vulnerable. It's not possible. Well, first, you need to create proper, set proper boundaries, set proper, yeah, criterion, so the sharing comes from a natural place. And again, everyone has to feel safe naturally. Nobody can impose that. But there's so much thirst and need for those spaces. And again, we don't need to wait for a, how to say, an official letter from whichever authority. Okay, you now have permission to sit in a circle and reveal your mind with someone. I mean, you don't need permission from anyone to do that. You already have that right, that duty, right? That right, so to say, and that need. And we are relational social creatures, so we need to share our journey. So yeah, feel totally invited and free to do so in whatever ways it works at this particular stage of your journey. Thank you. Okay, I'm seeing four more hands raised. So I will skip some of the breakthrough rooms. Now we can jump to the next one. In this case, if you allow me, we'll go to from France. Fasten your seatbelt. Landing into the future, we are going to New Zealand. So it's not Saturday. We are on Sunday now. So accommodate with the jet lag. It may take a few moments. And we are there with Bhadraji. So please, Bhadra, welcome.
Hare Krishna Maharaj and everybody. One of the things that I appreciate most about you and about the Sangha is the recognition of and the exploration into and the respect for different faith paths, different religions. And it's something that I started to get attracted to probably about a decade ago. And I've been a member of the Interfaith Council in my town for nearly that long. I'm actually going to an interfaith gathering this afternoon. I find it extremely enriching to be able to communicate with people of other faiths, the tenets of which might in some cases be different to or opposite from even those of the faith that I've chosen to follow. But we put that aside, those differences, and we connect just because we have the divine in common, and because we're human and we're having a human experience, and we recognize that the higher path, the evolved path, is to love each other despite differences. And it's just so enriching. And I have not found that amongst devotees, you know, Gaudiya devotees, except in this Sangha. So I find that very enriching. And I just wanted to ask you, Maharaj, considering, because you also have shown, you know, you show so much interest in and respect for different, the value of different faiths. I'm just wondering, considering the togetherness and the covenant identity of Judaism and the joyful abandon and longing for the divine of Sufism, and the deep respect for creation towards God of Zoroastrianism, for instance, and the meditation and inward prayer and connection with God of mystic Christianity, to give a few examples, why could you please explain and tell and define why it is that your chosen path is Gaudiya, Gaudiya Vaishnavism?
Sounds like a podcast. You started your own podcast, Bhadra. You're interviewing me now.
I'd just be interested to hear.
No, it's fine. It's fine, of course.
I could give my explanations as to why Gaudiya is my chosen path,
but I
just wanted to hear it from you.
Yeah, thank you for the question. Thank you for your appreciation in the beginning. Of course, I personally do not want to claim any exclusivity, like, okay, here into that Mya Sangha, we are the only ones who appreciate other traditions, and all the other Gaudiya groups are absolutely sectarian and fundamentalist. We are not saying any of that, of course. But I get your point that on a personal level, yeah, I really feel very inspired in that direction. And also, I don't feel it's just my own thing. Again, like we find that in a member from our own tradition, I will say someone that especially inspires me in that regard is Bhaktivinoda Thakur. No? His appearance day was yesterday, right? Today we are celebrating the disappearance day of Haridas Thakur, another Thakur. And yesterday I was reading, meanwhile I'm composing these articles that I told you on religious pluralism. Now you can imagine I'm quoting Bhaktivinoda Thakur a lot, but there was a quote that was shared by Ananga Manjari the other day. I will share it with you from his song Gitavali, his garland of song. Gitavali means a garland of songs. And there's one in song 5, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, let me read it because it's beautiful. And it's Bhaktivinoda Thakur. He says, he's speaking, I will say he's speaking to the Gaudiya Vaishnavas of his time. He says, why do you continue to hate the way the Lord is worshipped by people of other lands? There exists a number of authentic ways to worship God. according to the customs and various peoples living in different countries. Some people worship the Lord in an untidy or careless manner, wearing dreadlocks probably. Some worship him by bending down on their knees. Still others close their eyes and while worshiping his impersonal Brahman aspect. Some people worship him by assuming various yoga postures, and some immerse themselves in the congregational chanting of his holy names. But all of them worship that one and only supreme treasure that we Gaudiyas call Krishna. Therefore, you should all reflect a mood of brotherhood and live together in transcendental friendship. Bhaktivinoda Thakur ki jai. And thank you, Rasangi, for sharing that quote with me yesterday, the post of Ananga Manjari. I loved it and I included it in the articles I'm writing. So that's very clear, right? And we have many of those quotes, especially from someone like Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Like I remember quoting Radical Personalism, him saying, if you go to a mosque or to a church, you should reflect, oh, how these people are worshiping my Krishna. So interesting. I can appreciate that I can nourish my own faith in my own Ishtadev, so to say, by witnessing other people's faith. So there is big place for that. So just a few reflections on your words, because I think those are important, and those are, as you say, enriching, humbling. They expand our view. They allow us to rediscover our own tradition through the words and articulations of other schools. They prevent us from developing a superiority complex, right? Elitism. We are the highest, we are the best because this or that. And as you mentioned very nicely, Bhadra, highlighting some of the main features of these various traditions. And it's beautiful when you get to see that. I mean, it's very touching. Mm-hmm. So all that say, why am I Gaudiya Vaishnav? Many reasons, of course. As I will say, I could go to the beginning of Radical Personalism, as you may recall in the introduction that I mentioned, 10 reasons why not to stay as a Gaudiya Vaishnav, and 10 reasons why to stay as a Gaudiya Vaishnav. So I would say those are big part of the reasons, not only why I stay, but why I chose to become a Gaudiya Vaishnav. But in brief, where to begin? I mean, there is a lot. There is a lot, of course. There will be a lot. I won't be here today, I can tell you, after a few experiences. So it's very charming. It's very captivating theology. I have a theological, philosophical mind, and I was immediately captured by that when I read Bhagavad Gita and read all the other books, basically. It was so rich, so detailed, so deep, so poetic, so profound, so mind-blowing. I mean, the notions of God forgetting that he's God, and then on top of that you have Mahaprabhu. I mean, it's like, it's too much. No? And of course, this could be only a conceptual attraction on some level, but also, of course, there has been experiences to support that. No? It's not just pure fascination with the data. No? But some very touching experiences, whether it is chanting the names, serving, experiences in relationship, in community, in sharing with different sadhus, which again made me identify myself as a Gaudiya Vaishnava, but also to a point that allows me also to identify with the substance presence in these sister traditions. I don't want to identify myself as a Gaudiya Vaishnava to the extent that that doesn't allow me to identify myself with other traditions. I don't want to do that. The other day I was talking with Krishna Chandra Prabhu in Ananda Dham in Switzerland about another friend, sadhu friend of ours, who he's officially initiated in the Nimbarka Sampradaya, Vaishnav Sampradaya, but he has spent lots of time with the Gaudiya Sampradaya before, and he somehow feels himself, I have my Gaudiya heart, though I'm a Nimbarki. And he doesn't wear tilak. So I ask, because Krishna was asking me where I generally do not wear tilak, although I wear, but it's invisible, but it's there. But and he told me that this devotee doesn't wear tilak because he feels wearing tilak is too, for him, too limiting of, okay, this is my tradition and my school. I don't wear any other tila because I'm not from those traditions. So somehow it creates an exclusivity, which somehow, again, I'm not saying everyone should do what he's doing. I'm just giving an example of how one can feel in terms of, okay, I'm officially initiated in this sampradaya. I feel at home here. I feel I belong here. I feel I'm fascinating, but not to the point that I say I have nothing to do with Sufism. I don't feel I'm connected with mystical Christianity, and so on and so forth, right? Like, I always give this example that happened when we had this conversation with Ilia Delio, as you may recall, a few years ago. She came to my podcast. She's a Franciscan nun. She's a scientist. She's a theologian. She has like 5 PhDs. She's very humble at the same time. That's not easy, which 5 PhDs on your shoulder. Very incredible person. And I was in the conversation at one point, we were talking about the notion of divine play. And somehow the whole thing of God playing came into the scene, and God absorbed in play and forgetting who he is, forgetting that he's God because of the absorption in divine play. We call it Lila. And Ilia Delio is all the time like, yes, yes. It's like with her head nodding. And at one point she interrupts me and says like, I think I'm a Vaishnav. And of course, this is not an instance that I converted Ilia Delio live to Vaishnavism. No, no, she remains a Christian. But at the same time, she resonated 100% to that particular thing. So she felt, I'm a Vaishnav. At least in this particular thing, it doesn't mean we agree on everything. And I felt that, like, replying to her, well, when I'm listening to you, I think I'm a Christian. Now, of course, I do not officially align myself with Christianity in the doctrinal sense. I don't know, because I don't agree with many of the official doctrines of Christianity in terms of, I don't know, reincarnation and religious exclusivism and things that the Christian church have of their doctrinal rules. So I do not subscribe to that. But I don't personally feel that's the essence of mystical Christianity either. So yeah, personally, that's something that really fascinates me, the invitation for intimacy and the ongoing, ever-evolving, per prospect that our tradition gives in connection to the divine. And again, for me, it has been very beautiful and humbling, especially these last years, I will say. I always love to learn from different, drink from different fountains, you say? But the last few years have become more apparent, and with people coming into my life, personal relationships and mentors, and how incredible has been that I was able, only after meeting with many of them, name it Father Richard Rohr or others, I returned to Gaudiya Vaishnavism, and I'm finding all the things they're talking about, oh, that's also there in the Bhagavatam. Oh my gosh, I never saw it. But I could only see it after Franciscan told me about it in his own words and terms. Then I'm reading the Bhagavatam and say, oh, here it's love for nature and love for everyone and our relationship with God reflecting and how we treat the neighbor. It's all there. It's there. But I needed the grace of sister traditions. So that's why I like to keep that in place. As much as I, there is place for highlighting the uniqueness of Gaudiya Vaishnavism, hopefully not in any fanatic exclusivistic way, but for some reason we are here as Gaudiya Vaishnavas. So what keeps you here, so to say? So there are things to say, as I'm saying, but not to the point of losing sight and gratitude from those sister traditions. And again, at the end of the day, those are different approaches to the same one infinite reality. As the Bhagavatam, Srimad Bhagavatam, again, going to our tradition, going to the most foundational text, one of the most foundational verses of our most foundational text, Vedanti tattvavidas tattvam jnananadvayam brahmeti paramatmeti bhagavaniti shabdyate. Those who are seers of truth, tattva darshans, tattva bid, those who know reality, they describe reality as non-dual consciousness. So that's very non-sectarian. That's the beginning of the Bhagavatam, one of the main statements around which the whole book revolves. Reality is non-dual consciousness. And yes, then some will call it Brahman, Paramatma, Bhagavan. There are different ways of addressing that, but we are talking about one unified whole. So again, how much we can speak in terms of different traditions, how much they are different, how much they are the same. So yeah, it's a healing exercise for me to address them, and I'm surrounded by various works. Of course, I show this love poem from God, Daniel Ladinsky. Recently, I have been gifted this one by Kanupriya, the 40 rules of love, very interesting one about Sufism, the relationship between Rumi and Shams of Tabriz. So anyhow, and have other ones. This looks a little bit more narcissistic, but I had to show it. Just in case you don't have it yet, this is the latest. Somehow I read from that in class. That's why I'm carrying it. It's not that I'm self-centeredly reading my own book. So, so yeah, those will be some of the reasons, Badra. Thank you for that. I will
awesome,
go to breakthrough.
Maharaj.
We will go to breakthrough rooms now and invite you to share which are your reasons to feel connected with Gaudiya Vaishnavism and how you believe that connection in a way, hopefully, that doesn't disconnect you from other wisdom currents. So you will be invited now by Bhaktirasa to join our breakout rooms or breakthrough rooms. And for a few minutes, we will be sharing groups of three to gain more acquaintance with each other and continue sharing hearts, and see you back in a few minutes. Welcome back. Hope you had a nourishing time. A few minutes only. Sorry for that. It's always the thirst for more is there, so that's a good symptom. So we invite all of you to raise your hands again, those who had a question, but Rasangi was the first one, if I'm not failing my memory. So you're invited, Rasangi, to unmute yourself.
Anna Maharaj, I wanted to introduce you to my friend who's here for the first time. Her name is Chandrika. She lives in beautiful Hawaii, remnants of the spiritual world, so to speak, here. And she is a therapist and a poet. And her poetry has been relished deeply by Srila Narayana Maharaj, her Gurudev. Amazing poetry. Just amazing, beautiful poetry. She also swims with the dolphins and the whales. And she's really happy to be here today. And she has a question too, but I'm so happy to have her here. It's just amazing to be able to offer what we're experiencing here to our beloved friends. You know, come on in, try the water. It's fine here. Come try it out. And when they do, that's really special.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting Chandrika Rasangiji, and thank you, Chandrika, for accepting the invitation. We are honored to have you here today, and we appreciate your presence and contribution. And it's always lovely to meet poets who swim with whales and dolphins. Of course, if not, you are not a poet. You have to dare to do those type of things. So thank you so much. And so that was your, you have no question, Rasangi, no?
I have a question. Are you, of course, you know I have a question. Always have
you
a
have
question.
A question?
Yes, I do.
Oh, okay. I just wasn't sure if it was introduction to Chandrika or also something else.
Oh,
okay.
I have a little question.
Yeah, always a little question, Rasangi. Yeah.
And by the way, we were just talking about perhaps a retreat in Hawaii. Just saying. Okay. Okay, so, and she liked the idea very much. My question is, Maharaj, okay, in EDL, Evolution of Divine Love, you say in quotes, the only way to pay back love is to pay it forward, ever increasing its scope and depth. So that's a big one. And, you know, we know where that comes from. Krishna feels he can't pay back the love of the gopis, and apparently it's a goal. It's the goal of our life to try to pay back the love that we receive from Krishna, from God. That's like it. It's like, but how do we manifest it here? Like, what, it doesn't look the same as it does there necessarily, you know? And we all have this skewed idea of what's love, for goodness sakes, right? We all have our own impressions, albeit from different sources, from society, of what love is. So I'm just wondering, you know, I brought this up in the discussion of the book, and we're throwing things around, but, you know, how do we show our love here for one another? It doesn't look like just flowers and rainbows either.
Mm-hmm.
Really, really, what's real love here, genuine love here, and how does it manifest in our lives like today with each other and like that? That's it. Thanks.
Yeah, I will. Thank you. Thank you. Of course, first, I'd like to clarify that when I say the only way to pay love, to repay love is not paying back, but paying forward. In one sense, of course, it doesn't mean that if someone is loving you, you just need to extend the love to someone else and you cannot love that person back, right? I'm not forbidding that. The main point there is, as you referred to the Bhagavatam, is that the nature of love is that you can never pay back, literally. There is no way. There is no way to get to the number, so to say, because you lose sight of the number. There are no more numbers. It is uncountable. And this insight is coming from different traditions, connecting to our previous topic, just not to claim exclusivity. We go, the Vaishnav reached that unique insight nobody else did. No, I remember even before getting to know these beautiful verses from the Bhagavatam, Napariham Nirabhadya Sanjayam, Krishna telling the gopis, I cannot pay back, basically. I'm an eternal debtor. Reading mystics like Thomas Merton, he will say love is its own reward. And that's basically what this verse of the Bhagavatam is saying. Love is its own reward. So I wouldn't say that the goal of our life is to repay back that love, but to first realize that it cannot be repaid back. Because love is too much to be, like, to pay it back. It's something like similar to think of love can be deserved or love can be earned. It's not possible. Love is too much to use words like deserving or earning. That brings down love to some other category. We are talking here about a categorically different reality. So that's on one side. Love is too much to be deserved. Love is too much to be earned. And love is too much to be paid back, which doesn't mean we won't try our best. We will try, but the more we try, the more we increase the debt. That's the paradox of love. For us and for the divine, the more Radha and Krishna try to love each other, the more they feel they are not able to love each other as fully as they would like. And that brings them to a new level of loving interaction and a new level of loving interaction, like Srila Bhakti Rakshakshardev Goswami Maharaj will say, that Sri Radha says the only pain in me, and we talked about that in Radhastami the other day in Spanish, I think it was. She said, because, I mean, we hear about the pain of Sri Radha in separation from Krishna or so many forms of divine sacred suffering. But she will say at the end, like in the words of Srila Siddhar Maharaj, my only pain is that I'm not able to fully give myself to Krishna. That's her subjective experience. Of course, we wouldn't agree with that. We will respectfully disagree with Swamini and say, you are the embodiment of what it means to give yourself all to Krishna. But the paradoxical subjective experience of love is you can always give yourself more. So that gives you that divine dissatisfaction. So that's on one side. Yeah. Again, these are not just concepts. Of course, we need to eventually live them and have an experience of how endless prospect love is offering us. And then going back to planet Earth and where we are here now, how to be grounded and embodied in all this, how to embody all these ideas. It all starts home, I will say. It all starts in how we relate and treat one another. To keep our high theological concepts realistic, okay, keep applying them in your day-to-day relationships. So you are not going on a theological trip in your mind. I'm saying that for myself because I can very easily go on those trips and you become disassociated from the day-to-day relationships and what they expect from you. Like I was reading this book that I mentioned, The 40 Rules of Love, and it's interesting. And one of the rules is, it says, okay, it's relatively easy to love God because God is perfect and all attractive and all beautiful, so to say. But what about loving those who are not any of that, in one sense, at least in how they behave? Then comes the real invitation to learn to love. Again, we talk about love, we talk about unconditional love. So probably a good way to see how unconditional is my love is to see how do I love those people who are not precisely perfect in how they behave. Because if I just fall in love with God in my mind, with a perfect, all beautiful God, but I'm not able to somehow love that which is not all beautiful, but which still is connected with God, then that speaks about my love of God as well. Because again, everything is interrelated. Or how I treat myself. Again, that's another conversation. Like we always quote Dorothy Day, right? I only love God as much as I love the person I love the least. And sometimes that person is us. I only love God as much as I love the person I love the least. Sometimes that person is not the president of the country or my neighbor or that guy or this. It's me. I'm the person I love the least. So how can I demonstrate, express my love for God in how I treat myself? That's demanding. Again, it's not easy, but it's all part of the culture of love. It's a culture. It's cultivation. It's a daily intentional choice. It's choosing love above all else every single time. And sometimes we fail and we choose something else. So it's going back to the intentional investment and choosing love in its unconditionality as much as we can. And it will entail falling short of it, missing the mark, all the stuff that is part of the journey. But yeah, I think to keep it realistic, and that's what the scripture said, right? I mean, we don't need to go to other traditions, so to say. We can just go again to the Bhagavatam, this famous series of verses, beautiful verses, very intense verses, spoken by Kapila Dev on Archana, worship of the deity, which basically is another way of speaking about relationship with God, because that's what it is, ideally, Archana. And all those verses are about, if you worship the deity but mistreat other living beings, your worship is useless. I mean, he used strong words. You are throwing ash into the fire. You know, like you are nonsense. So every time, all these verses, the same notion from different angles and words. If you worship God but fail to see God in the other person, if you worship, praise God, but mistreat other living beings, if you say you love God but you behave unlovingly with yourself, with others, then that's not coherent. So, and it's okay. I'm not saying that to make anyone feel terrible, but just to get as closer as we can to a coherent definition of love, right? A love that is coherent in every direction. So I would say that's part of how we can measure our progress. We become less and less contradictory in how we express love. We are on the path of love, but in the beginning we may be contradictory. We love Krishna and we cannot love anyone else apart from Krishna in the altar. We love Krishna in the altar, we hate Krishna in the heart of my neighbor. And Krishna is in the heart of my neighbor saying, why you are treating me like this? I'm the same guy that is here in this heart over there in the altar, you're worshiping me. why you put me a garland there and throw a whipping here? I'm here also. But we cannot see that yet, right? We have hyper-localized God in one corner of one room, and we cannot extend still that to other places. That is part of the journey, it's part of the process, but eventually that's the idea. We perceive God's presence so much everywhere that we cannot mistreat anything, but we just can revere every pore of existence. Every pore of existence is venerable ultimately. But again, that's the ultimate vision of the Uttam Mahabhagavat. So we cannot force ourselves to be there, but we can keep that vision in mind, knowing that's how reality looks like in its ideal form. So I can long for that vision, and I can practice where I am, no, reminding myself that's how reality looks like, and that's how I'm being invited to treat everyone. Bearing in mind the sacredness of everything. So what do you think, Rasang? Does it make any sense?
Well, I love that. I love that. And I also have like a caveat to that, that it, because our Sangha is what it is, if I don't know what love is in a certain circumstance, I can turn to my sisters or my brothers and say, I'm confused about what to do here. What is loving here?
Yeah.
And that works. It seems to really lift the veil and allow that way, that path to be open. So we can't do it alone. We have each other. You know, we have access to that, which is such a gift, right?
Yeah.
Such a gift.
Thank you. Yeah, and of course, as you say, sometimes we may not know what love is or how love is to be expressed in any given situation, because also love is ever evolving and always expanding. So we cannot just trap love in one's definition and then I got it and I know what love is always in every moment. No, it can be perplexing at times, like how I'm being invited to express love in this particular scenario. So it's part of the loving journey to rediscover love or redefine love in finer and deeper ways. So, and yeah, sometimes we need help, lots of times, not sometimes, help and support. And that's part of love, right? It's always relational and reciprocal. So thank you. Okay, let's go to Karuneshwari. I'll skip the breakthrough room. We'll go to Karuneshwari and then we'll conclude with Chandrika. So we have two more offerings today, please. Welcome, Karuneshwari. Flying from California, I forgot to say now, back to Ireland.
So only I'm in England.
Okay. Well, not so far.
But I'll be in Ireland next week.
Okay, I wanted just to make sure we'll be meeting over there.
Great. We will. Looking forward to it. Sometimes when I'm going to ask a question here, I get just a little bit nervous in case the question is just a bit dodgy. I always feel like kind
dodgy.
Of at the edge.
You mean dodgy?
Mm-hmm. I don't know. Dodgy. I mean, yeah, like just a little bit, maybe, you know, on the edge of, you know, just about being an okay question, or is it bordering on something that you shouldn't really say? At the same time,
uncensored, satsang.
At the same time, like it's definitely, you know, related to, you know, your book and some articles that you've written. So the question is that, you know, not just with yourself to take the focus off you, but also with the whole Sangha or a lot of the Sangha. I feel like, you know, we've really needed like a fresh understanding of the Shastras. And we've discussed that so much, you know, not saying anything new yet. We've needed like a updating of things that we find hard to understand or things that were disturbing. So when I look at it, you know, there was one time I listened to one of your podcasts, I can't remember which one, but there was a lot of really healthy dialogue about, you know, being human, humanity, understanding the masculine, understanding the feminine. And I remember thinking, this feels like, from listening to these kind of conversations, like I can evolve and grow. And at that time, particularly maybe about 6 months ago, when I was going directly to some of the Shastra and some of the purports, I wasn't feeling that same nourishment. And at the same time, I could understand the absolute message behind it all, that Krishna is God, and that I can accept. But the finer details of what I needed at that time to sort of feel I was evolving and growing, I wasn't finding it there. So my question is it okay to say that this sort of what we're all kind of feeling that we need and what this Sangha has really been pursuing, which is a more kind of wholesome human explanation of the path and the process, is it okay, is it improper to think that that's an evolution in the presentation of, you know, this philosophy? Because when we look at, you know, previous explanations, they don't focus so much, as far as I can see, on humanity and bringing the whole person into it. They focus more on, you know, the absolute philosophy and, you know, the philosophy of who we are, who Krishna is, what the world is, but not so much a healthy way to practice it. And, you know, can we say this is part of the evolution of divine love? Is it okay to say that the presentation has needed to evolve and that it is evolving? Because it feels like saying that means that it was lacking before. So that's my dodgy question.
Thank you. Yeah, but I will say, yeah, there is a place to say there is an evolution. Of course, now comes the clarification, right? Not to make that claim exclusively from, I don't know, this particular Sangha, because then comes all the classical exclusivism and superiority complex, like, yeah, we are the future of the tradition and only us are doing that. And that's not true. That's not true. We may be known as emphasizing some specific topics, but that doesn't make us any better than anyone else. And that doesn't mean that any other person from other sanghas are not emphasizing those topics. And that doesn't mean that people from this sangha are dysfunctional in those topics, even as much as they emphasize them. So anything can happen everywhere. As for the evolution of the presentation, of course, again, reality is ever evolving. So we always need an evolution in the presentation. It's not that, but it doesn't mean that because it was incomplete or it was bad or it was lacking. But many times these presentations are also, again, like it or not, are coming in a particular, presented in a particular time and place, and they're using certain language, addressing certain things that if we are out of that particular chapter of history, they may seem unrelatable to us. But it doesn't mean that they were not enough for their time. But it doesn't mean that we need to just force ourselves for that to be enough for us at our time. So again, that's the dynamics of parampara. Evam parampara praptami man rajarsa yobidu, Krishna says in the Gita, yogonashta parampara sakalin nihat mahata. No, with the passing of time, we need a constant revival of parampara. And it's not that the past was wrong. It's just that the living current is living. So if the thing is living, it requires a constant living presentation of that. And this takes two forms. One of the more relative side of adjusting words, concepts to time, place, and circumstance, considering the audience, but also adding new inner realizations to the presentation. Because it will be false humility to say, okay, my previous guru said everything, so I have nothing to add to that. No, I will say, by their grace, I may be able to say something more. Not because I'm better than them, but by their grace, something else can be revealed. That's parampara. The literal meaning of parampara is one after another, one contribution after another, and after another. And that means taking responsibility for your role to play in the parampara. It's not just, my Gurudev is so glorious, so glorious. It all goes to him. He said everything, so I don't need to say anything myself. That's escapism. Because your Gurudev wants you to do your own contribution to this parampara and the next generation, because it's ongoing. It's an endless current of ever-evolving contributions. So it's beautiful and it's humbling. Of course, some may misread that from the outside. Oh, you are proud. You think you can say something new. Who you think you are? But that's not a healthy understanding. Healthy understanding is humbling. It's inviting us to take responsibility, to be creative, to employ all our faculties for the glory of Bhagavan and everyone. So So there is place to speak about an evolution. I actually speak about that in the book, in Evolution of Divine Love. I even speak about, I know this may be intense expressions, but I use the term updatable scripture, right? Not to say that we don't need the Bhagavatam any longer or anything, but there's always an update, an upgrade. There's always something new that can be said. And the very scriptures say that. It's not that the scriptures say, this is the final word, nobody else can say anything about it. On the contrary. No? It's not that the Goswami say everything is in the Bhagavatam, so we don't write any books. They wrote so much based on the Bhagavatam. Continue churning and extracting. And then next generation. And so that's basically the nature of the living current. So we are part of that. It's a living current. And as I made the play of words in English, the current must remain current. No? No? And for that, we need to make our own contribution and think for ourselves and how our own experiences and speak that in our own language, in our own, not language, only native tongue, but in our own language in every sense of the term. So yeah, I can think, okay, now we are here 2025, but if we will be now 1 century in the future ahead, probably we will be looking back to what we are doing now, and it may seem quite primitive. Because that's a relativity of time, right? You look back and say like, oh, that was so primitive. Wow, they didn't address this and this and this, whatever that may be, that we cannot even think about it now. That's the idea, that's the hope. But not that so primitive in a critical way. I'm kind of joking. If that came from a sincere place, we won't have to say those Neanderthal-like Vaishnavas doing that stuff a century ago. But it's like, wow, incredible how they did what they did at that time and how that... And they imagining how that could have been the ideal thing for that time. Incredible. But then go back to your present time and realizing, oh, we are confronted with those, with necessities and things that need to be addressed and said and integrated into the tradition. And especially, I would say, connected to a line like Bhaktivinoda Thakur's line, Bhaktivinoda Parivar, who has so much always an openness to interact with modernity, with the other side of the world, with other traditions, as we were talking, with other disciplines, I will say, not even other spiritual traditions, but with secular disciplines like psychology, history, science. I mean, we need to, and I'm not saying nobody's doing that. I see many Gaudiya Vaishnavas and many other spiritual people becoming more and more awakened to the necessity of keeping an ongoing open conversation to, and allowing themselves to be enlightened about their own tradition, not only from other spiritual traditions, as I say, but even by secular disciplines. How can science and psychology inform my Gaudiya Vaishnavism? That's an interesting question that we could spend some time with. Am I allowing that to happen? Am I open to that possibility? I'm putting science and psychologists all in the secular box that they don't have anything to teach me, and so on and so forth. So yeah, it's an exciting, that for me what keeps the whole belonging to a tradition exciting. You are honoring the ancient wisdom, and you acknowledge the eternal principles revealed there, but also you realize there is always place for further articulation and expansion and experience. And so it's a living current. Welcome to the current. Let's continue swimming. Yeah. And since we are speaking about swimming, we'll go to Chandrika, that Rasang introduced her as a poet who likes to swim with dolphins and whales. So let's keep the swimming analogy and swim from UK to Hawaii. That will be a long swim, but it will be a nice one. It's a promising one. Rasang is a spiritual world on earth. Never been to Hawaii, but we'll trust that. So do a long swim. And we are there in Hawaii welcoming Chandrika, and thank you so much for being here today, honoring our meeting. And please unmute yourself, whatever you may like to share with us.
Oh, thank you, Maharaj. I think we have time for me to either share a poem or ask a question. I'll let you decide.
Oh,
Unless we sometimes go over a little over time, but
I'm tempted with both.
That brought tears when you were talking about how we all have a contribution, we all have something to share. Because, you know, my Gurudev was so encouraging about the poetry. And I write poetry from, you know, Krishna expressing his separation from Radha and from Radha's perspective. And he was so encouraging. And this one devotee on Maui said, "I can't stand your egoistic poetry displays." And once my Gurudev left, pretty much everyone in the whole Sangha stopped inviting me to share poetry. And my Gurudev asked me to write a poetry book, and I still haven't done it. And
let's do it.
So that really touched me and brought tears, and I know I must do it. One time, Srila Narayan Maharaj Gurudev said, "I like your poetry. It's as if you're offering your heart on a golden tray." And I went off and I wrote this poem, and you're inspiring me to share it. I'm very inspired. I'm very grateful to Rasangi, and I'm very grateful to you, Maharaj. "If I offer my heart on a tray of gold, like a flower or lamp, you will accept, I am told, and never return it to follow a dead end road. You will offer my heart to that couple divine, where it can beat to the sound of Shyam's flute and the footsteps of gopis dancing around. If I offer my heart on a tray of gold cast in prayer, will you see a sprout of sincerity there? And water that tiny creeper with words flowing, the praying of divine love, and you're knowing everything I need to feed my soul. When I'm lost in the hole of my misdirected mind, will you find me when I am far from your lotus bud feet? Drop a rope of 108 beads into the well where I fell and remind me to clasp hold. Dancing fingers, dancing tongue, dancing with you into Vrindavan, following the mystic attraction of his flute, feeling Radha's love so pure, final cure of my disease, so intense, the blue-hued boys entranced and mystified, to melt my heart, to cry and cry."
Hi, thank you so much.
You're welcome. And now for my question, which is
on another. Don't go to the question so far, so fast. Allow us a few moments to internalize the gift. Thank you. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That's beautiful. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I'm very glad to know that your Gurudev encouraged you to offer yourself through poetry. It's such a beautiful way, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank you. Chaitanya Charitamrita, there's one line that say, "Aiti kavitva binu nahi rasira prachar," which basically means when it comes to speak about rasa, about loving devotion mellows, we cannot not employ poetry. No, I mean, poetry is the only resource available at that point, when we have to describe what happens in the realm of love. So that's a very powerful line from Chaitanya Charitamrita, encouraging poets, I will say. I'm glad to see, I'm always blessed to witness a poet being encouraged, because we need poets in this world. We need more poetry to keep the world alive, enchanted, as it actually is. Poets are basically people who remind us how we live in an enchanted reality, right? So thank you for giving us a glimpse of that. And thank you. If you had a question, no problem. We are all fully satisfied with the poetry, but you can bring the question so we can reach a new level of satisfaction after that.
And if time is an issue, I can hold the question till next time.
No, we have a few minutes. I may not be able to answer with all the detailed time that it may deserve. So if you prefer to have more time for the answer, we can have it other day. But if not, I can reply in some minutes.
Oh, okay. I'll go for it. So I'm a therapist, and I'm also trained and certified in internal family systems. I don't know if you've heard of it.
Yeah.
And I think Dick Schwartz has something that to teach and that can be helpful for devotees. So he found that we're all multiples. You know, there's DID, used to be called multiple personality disorder, but he said everyone is a multiple. And he found that every part of every person is good in the sense the part has a positive intention towards the person.
Mm-hmm.
And he found that everyone has a core self or soul that is not impacted by anything the person has gone through psychologically. And where things go awry is that parts get stuck in the past, get stuck at points of trauma, and get stuck in roles. And I found in my work with devotees, I love working with devotees and can be more challenging. I found with devotees, a lot of devotees, maybe women more than men, have a very powerful internal critic. And I'm speaking from Western mentality because I sense it's different for Indian mentality. One time an Indian sannyasi told me, we don't do guilt, we don't do shame. Whereas in the Western mentality, the research shows that internal criticism increases the desire to change and at the same time makes it harder to change. And you're nodding. And the positive intention of the internal critic tends to be to protect the person from criticism. So it tends to start in early childhood. Maybe there's a critical parent, sibling, teacher, somebody. And because children tend to blame themselves when the parents are acting in whatever way they're acting, the internal critic protects the person from criticism. If only I criticize my person internally, they will be perfect enough that they will no longer be criticized. So that's the positive intention. And every time I've asked an internal critic, you know, as I'm facilitating, if the critic likes their role, no, they don't. There's other parts that criticize them for their role. And if you ask them if, you know, about the impact and help them become aware of the impact, they're aware that it's causing problems, that, you know, it tends to increase shame until the person's drowning in shame. And then, of course, another common part when there's particularly painful emotions is a distractor protector or a firefighter protector that will distract or direct the person into some addictive behavior to numb the pain, to avoid the pain, to, you know, make it go away in some way. So I see that a lot with devotees. And so I think I already know your answer from your nodding, but my question was, how do you see humility versus debilitating internal criticism? And how does one develop humility while avoiding the pitfall of what I've observed, that debilitating internal criticism?
Thank you. Thank you. And as I told you, I'm sorry that I don't have enough time to reply in all the detail that the question deserves it, because it requires long treatment. It's a very important question. I will say something, of course, but yeah. It's an important one. Somehow I'm reminded of a series of lectures I remember we did in in New Zealand at the beginning of this year, where we studied in detail the third verse of Shikshastakam, which speaks about humility, Trinada Pisunichina, but many times it's weaponized, basically, or humility is brought to the picture in a way that is dehumanizing, again, not bringing us to any dignified place, so to say. But yeah, basically with all that you mentioned, I agree, and I agree that as a therapist, working with devotees can be especially challenging. I'm not limiting to a devotee audience, but many times with people coming from religious backgrounds where certain ideas about, again, humility or surrender or perfection, standards of perfection and absolute ideas can all be put together in the mixer and create a time bomb in many ways if we don't have a healthy psychological framework to hold space for all of that in a way that is really healthy and healing. So I will say that humility is not about feeling bad about myself, no, to begin with. Of course, we have levels of humility and we have great personalities expressing humility in ways we cannot even understand them, I will say. But we cannot imitate them to begin with. If I cannot understand why they are saying what they are saying, I shouldn't do copy-paste of that.
Well,
but I will say that humility has to be the natural response when we truly witness something that is bigger than ourselves. So I really give myself to that out of awe and wonder, right? Like I like to say that, for example, surrender, which is another classical word that's unfortunately is weaponized sometimes to create minimizing effects in one's own self-image. But we should not surrender out of fear, out of intimidation, out of pressure, out of feeling miserable about myself. We should surrender out of awe and wonder. I'm in front of something so beautiful, so enchanting, I feel drawn to give myself. So humility should be something like that. I'm in front of something so deep, so beautiful, that I bow to that. You know, I honor that, I venerate that, I feel blessed by that. And for example, I like to give this example that Mahaprabhu himself gives, Trinada Pisunichena. He said, the translation is be more humble than a blade of grass. Sometimes that's translated of be lower than the straw in the street. So that's an interesting addition to the actual original, which lends itself for misinterpretation, right? You should feel lower than the straw in the street. But the verse says be more humble than a blade of grass, which is not the same. I'm not saying that the translation is wrong. I'm just saying it lends to misinterpretation if we are not careful. But the imaginary of Mahaprabhu is grass. How the grass is bending without breaking. No, the grass will do like this, the wind will carry, and then will. No? So it's not breaking in its bending. So for me, the analogy is very interesting because it's saying when you bend, when you practice humility, do it in a way that is not breaking you. No, it should be dignifying. Now, if I'm in front of an elder, of a beautiful soul, of a person that I feel I'm very nourished, I will be humbled by that. And of course, ultimately, we should be humbled by everyone and everything, but we have to begin somewhere. That's what I'm making, because if I tell you should be humbled by everything, it may sound too much to begin with. But when that happens, it happens in a way that is dignifying, that I feel loved, that I feel nourished, that I feel some higher current is coming to my life, and I want to put my head on the ground. Again, not feeling bad about myself, but feeling blessed by something so high coming to my life. So feeling grateful, feeling gifted, feeling blessed. So I honor that, I revere that, and I want to serve that. That's for me the actual meaning of humility, right? Not feeling terrible about myself and over-identifying with that and then augmenting the problem even more, no? And even more and even more. So we judge the tree by its fruits. No? If in the name of humility I'm becoming dysfunctional, depressed, or who knows what. There are so many unnecessary symptoms. I mean, the inner critic, I'm not saying it's bad to have an inner critic, but it has to be not a relentless inner critic, but it has to be a friend. Like Krishna says in the Gita, your mind out of control, your worst enemy. That will mean a relentless inner critic. Your mind under control, your best friend. That will be a constructive friend who is sharing feedback for your best interest. So it's important to build those inner resources, to make friendship with our mind, so the mind itself mirrors back positive feedback. Positive feedback can be also constructive criticism, but it's positive. It comes with a positive intention and with a positive outlook. But if not, that's not humility, right? Humility makes me feel more and more miserable about myself in a dysfunctional way. That's something else. Oh. I don't know if that makes any sense.
It totally makes sense. Yeah. And the research shows encouragement is more effective than criticism. So when internal criticisms are asked the question, do you want to be more effective and less harsh? The critics are like, yes, I want to help my person, you know? And then when the critics shift into, you know, you can do this bhakti. If you chant, you'll feel, you know, it'll help heal, it'll feel better, you know, and when they shift, it actually makes it easier for the devotee to practice the sadhana. And, and so often with devotees, that those high standards are weaponized internally, you know, like, I'll never be good enough. I can't do this. This is like, I'm hopeless, you know? So, yeah.
That's why big part, at least from my presentation, is a lot on how Krishna really loves you unconditionally. Because many times we get neurotic about high standards and reaching perfection, and only then I will receive Krishna's attention. Only then I will belong. It's like, no, you're already loved and fully accepted by the divine. And we practice to return the embrace, to return the loving embrace that we have already received. It's not about exhausting ourselves to death so he finally sends us a sidelong glance. No, we are already being fully loved and accepted. So begin on that positive note. You are already loved. And then we can work on the stuff that needs to be worked, which is not so positive, so to say, inside of us, but on the foundation that you're already loved and accepted. So it, for me at least, reorients the whole practice to practice for the right reasons. As you were saying before, Chandrika, sometimes people look for perfection and look for change only because they hate themselves, basically. They have zero self-acceptance, so they're obsessed with changing, not because they are in a dynamic, loving expression, but because they cannot accept who they are in any single way. And by trying to change from that place, as you say, they do not change. The situation changes. I mean, changes for worse. So for me, it's very important that we have the right motivation. Why I'm practicing, why I'm doing all this? Because I hate myself in the background? Probably. It may be a possibility. We may need to be courageous enough to deconstruct that false motivation and rediscover how to be a devotee from a healthy place or from a holistic healing place. So, yeah. Thank you. Thank you for bringing that topic. Very important one. And we need to have this type of conversations a lot. This is Anarthani Vritti 2.0 for me. No, because Anarthani Vritti is not just chant your rounds and all confusion and all anarthas will magically disappear. It's gain an awareness of all that gets in the way. And many of these things are shame, toxic shame. And that sometimes we don't even think of it as an anartha. We are most like lust, greed, anger. That's it. End of the list. But you have things that are way worse, that are in the back of all that, like deep ingrained shame where I feel I'm bad intrinsically, in the root. And you need to address that and to heal that. As if not, that affects your whole perspective of everything. So yeah, we have lots of work to do. That's part of our contribution to the parampara, as we're talking before. Thank you. Thank you so much to all of you. And we will conclude with one last breakthrough room to share some reflections based on this last topic we have been talking, which I think is an important one. So be generous with your time. Gift us a few more minutes, six more minutes, six, seven. And we'll see you in a few minutes back for the final farewell for today. So, okay. Welcome all you back. Hoping you had a nourishing time together, and want to say you've goodbye one more time for today. Thank you so much for the gift of your presence and your contribution, questions, tears, smiles, laughter, comments, everything. And looking forward to meeting you next week, though I'm still confirming if I will be available, because remember, next weekend we have this conference with Mahatma Prabhu and Dhanya and Sukabaha, which I hope you can join, because it will be very related to the things we are talking about these days, no? To have the courage to be real. That's kind of the title of the series. So looking forward to meet you there, but probably I think the timing will allow to have our meeting. So we'll be confirming these days. Thank you so much, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu ki jai, Harinam Sankirtan ki jai, Gaur Bhaktavrinda ki jai, Samaveda Bhaktavrinda ki jai, Gaur Premananda Hari Bol, Panchakalpatarubhyas, Jagapasindubhyai Vacha, Patitanam Pavanebhyo, Vaishnavibhyo, Namo Namaha.